Big news. Over at the Intensive Care Academy, of course, that's our other project, a video-based, subscriber-based learning platform where you can learn all kinds of critical care at your own pace, a great accompaniment to this podcast. We are now accredited for continuing education. So if you need CME hours of any flavor, this will be applicable for just about any role in the United States and perhaps elsewhere. You can go and get a substantial number of hours just for being a member. Go check it out, guys. This is a big milestone we've been working on for some time, and I know it's something that a lot of you have wanted. No additional cost for members. You can consume the material at your own pace, and you should be eligible for CME every single year. Go check it out, ICU101.com. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brian Bowling, and with me as always is my co-host, Brandon Odo.
You.
We thought we would talk about sort of a grab bag of GI stuff today. You know, and we're chatting before the recording here, and Brandon mentioned, you know, probably any of these could make its own decent episode, but we thought we'd just start off with just some kind of random GI topics. And who better than our old friend Elliot Tapper, who's a hepatologist at the University of Michigan. He's been on the show before. Been a while, but I was just telling him I still recommend his episode on GI bleeds every time I teach about GI bleeds. Welcome back to the podcast.
So Elliot,
great to be here.
We're going to just play Ask a Gastroenterologist, all the kind of random questions that somebody might have in mind that they would love to get an expert perspective on, you know, in and involving the GI tract. So you just tell us what you think. I mean, a lot of this probably may not be evidence-based. There may not be a guideline. It's just kind of what you think. Let's start real simple. Laxatives and cathartics. What's your approach to prescribing a regimen of these things in general for constipation? And you can assume that all this is in the context of the ICU, because of course some of these answers might differ elsewhere.
Okay, so I would like to frame this discussion like you would about heart failure. In general, when it comes to constipation, we'll call it gut failure. You're going to have some people that are preload dependent, some people that have low squeeze or contractility, some people that have afterload problems. So afterload, some people are going to be constipated because of an outlet obstruction, and that person needs to have a disimpaction. Frequently, I would get pages as a fellow saying, can you come do this? There's nothing special about my finger. But it is a potentially life-saving procedure insofar as these people will get super sick with AFib or delirious. And although you should practice how to gown up, and I had a good video that I would share in my notes for how to protect yourself well and what kind of ointment to rub under your nose, it might not be glamorous, but it would definitely be helpful to the patient. So keep that in mind.
And you would know that's the case based on what? I mean, I feel like for us, it's usually you get like a CT scan and they have a bunch of like stool in the rectum.
Yeah.
I mean, is there an easier
way? Yeah, I mean, so like, obviously by the time they're in the ICU, everyone's had a CAT scan of some sort and you will see a giant stool ball. And so it may not be a surprise. But if someone is severely constipated and you have less than expected output, a DRE, rectal exam is a reasonable place to start. In the clinic, like not necessarily ICU, we will do this. We will examine and we'll have people try to bear down, and you can get a sense of whether or not there's paradoxical motion of the pelvic floor, where some people, by way of whatever is happening neurologically or neuropsychiatrically, they have a paradoxical motion when they bear down. Instead of squeezing out, they're basically squeezing up, and they're less able to evacuate. So not only can you learn about something that's obstructing their outlet, you can learn a little bit about muscle function, but that's more of an outpatient pearl, if you will. So the least glamorous topic we led with, right? Afterload. There we go. You might think about glycerol suppositories if that might be helpful for somebody. Then the next thing that most people focus on when it comes to relieving constipation is preload. So getting more water into the lumen. And in this case, the bread and butter of osmotic laxatives is going to be things like polyethylene glycol or Miralax. Lactulose will do it, but I only use that for people with cirrhosis. Miralax has less gas formation. And the colonoscopy prep, the 4 liters of Go Lightly, all that is a nuclear dose of Miralax. So increasing that is the gentlest, best way to increase water in the gut. There are drugs that will do this too. And these are generally prescribed outpatient. I'm not recommending this in the ICU, but just so we're clear on the mechanism here, a lot of the most popular medications in GI world are things like linaclotide, and these are effectively tricking the chloride pump. They're like giving you a mild version of cholera to increase the amount of water in the gut to move the poop along. So preload-dependent issues, Miralax, that's your solution. Some people, they just have a low contractility state. They need some more squeeze. The classic ones you're going to get here are Senna. That's how it works. Increasing squeeze, Senna, bisacodyl, and it will work on the where it gets contact in the gut. So if you give oral bisacodyl, then it's going to be mainly the squeeze in the ascending colon. So if all of their stool is in the left colon and you're squeezing the ascending colon, you're just going to get cramps. You're not going to relieve the constipation. And that's a person who needs a bisacodyl suppository. And sometimes people will need both, but you just want to time it up because you know it's going to take a little while for the bisacodyl to get to the ascending colon. And then you can mix and match. And then you've got bisacodyl plus a lot of, plus Go Lightly. So you chase the bisacodyl with Go Lightly, and then you'll have varying degrees of effectiveness from your combination therapy as you account for the various different failure types of your patient's colon.
I think it takes a special kind of person to explain constipation and bowel management to ICU providers by making it sound like heart failure. But I don't think I've ever understood this topic more than right now.
Okay, well, I'm glad.
That made so much sense to me.
Yeah.
One thing I want to ask, though, so we talk a lot about just, you know, in the ICU, we do this kind of checklist every day on every patient. And one of the things is, you know, are they having appropriate bowel function? And so what I was taught and what I continue to practice is at least every 3 days, no more than 3 to 4 times a day. And that's how you sort of adjust things. At what point should we really, is that a decent guideline? Or should we just really say like, okay, when I admit somebody to the ICU, I'm going to put them on some Senna and that's that. And at what point do I need to be like, well, we need to escalate things. Cause I do feel like being ahead of it is probably better than waiting until they're like, hey, it's been 8 days and they haven't had a bowel movement. They need a huge enema.
Yeah. I agree. And so I guess in reverse, the enema is also a great treatment for other than glycerol suppository. Agree. Like, so I would say what you just described about the 3 bowel movements a day or once every 3 days, that's the bell curve. That's the normal distribution of pooping in the population. And so it's not a disease if it's within those timeframes. But also what matters is if it bothers somebody. So somebody who's having 3 bowel movements a day and it's bothering them, then you might want to address it. In this case, if someone's within that bell curve, we don't necessarily want to mess with it. But we're also doing a ton of things to people that will cause problems in the days to come. And so places where you certainly need to be proactive is when you're starting a medication that's going to interfere with colon function. And in the first one that comes to mind for me is opioids, right? So if you're starting an opioid, then that person is going to be constipated or more constipated than they were before. And that's where you want to kick it up a notch with the Senna or scheduled Miralax so that you avoid getting into trouble in the days to come. But I think as long as you're tracking it, if you're able to track this patient's symptoms or they're just sedated and you're not aware, then I would say I would err on the side of gently starting things like the Senna or Miralax as needed, because so much of what we're doing is sedating or paralyzing to smooth muscle. But as long as you're tracking bowel output and you're not getting into trouble with diarrhea, you're probably in a good spot.
Okay. Well, let's go to the other end of the GI tract, antiemetics. Patients having nausea, maybe vomiting, pretty everyday thing in the critically ill population, sometimes for very specific reasons, sometimes just kind of the prodrome of being ill. Of course, nausea can have different contexts in other settings, the chemo patient and so on. But for the, that kind of general nauseous person, I feel like a lot of us, our whole approach is to give them some Zofran, ondansetron, and then if it doesn't work, throw up our hands. Or we start, we just kind of pull random other ones that we remember from the shelf, but without any real approach. What's your clever analogy here?
Okay, so I wish I had more clever stuff, but I would just say that we make our patients nauseous all of the time, and this definitely, although we're talking about the other end, these things are intrinsically related because the constipated person is going to be nauseous. And nausea is often caused by that. So point one is that. Point two is, I agree with you. Zofran is kind of like, ondansetron is a terrific generic name. And it is also a miracle medication. Having taken it myself, it is no joke. It often doesn't work. And in that case, we're thinking about our own cocktail of medications that we prefer. And it will vary between Compazine to olanzapine and metoclopramide. These are the things that you'll see tossed around. In general, there's more evidence for things like olanzapine in the context of chemotherapy. I do like to use it at relatively low doses, particularly if there's other indications for it. Where you get into some trouble in the hospital is a lot of the hand-wringing around QTC prolongation. Now, none of us have ever seen torsades result from a dose of ondansetron. And yet, we will just let people suffer forever. Or we'll try whatever. I'm afraid I don't know the generic name, but the thing called Tigan. Do you know the generic name for this?
No.
When I was a resident, it was like $1,000 a pop or something, but now it's generic. But it doesn't modify the QTC. It also doesn't improve nausea at all.
Trimethobenzamide.
Trimethobenzamide. Well, there's a reason why I didn't remember that. But that's what I'll be using heretofore. Okay, trimethobenzamide.
So it meets one of two criteria, but the criteria...
Yeah, exactly. So... unfortunately, a lot of these agents do prolong the QTC. So if you know that somebody has a sky high one, then like I wouldn't mess around. But if it's in the high 400s and they're suffering, then something like olanzapine or Compazine is often helpful. And if they're in the middle of vomiting, many of these things have a per rectal administration regimens routes. However, one of the things I will use over the phone for many of my patients who are nauseated, and sometimes when they're in extremis in the hospital, is I'll round with isopropyl alcohol swabs. Do you know what I'm talking about? So there is evidence wherein it has been compared in the ED setting over the short course that sniffing a isopropyl alcohol wipe is superior to oral ondansetron. So these are people where you want to try to avoid IV access, and equivalent to IV ondansetron. And so when you're just standing there in front of a patient who is upset, I will give it a shot. And I found that it doesn't work every time, but it does work about two out of three times. And so how long does it work for is a question. In my experience, it's short-lived, but sometimes just the ability to stop it in its track, what it will do is it will calm somebody down so there's less anxiety around this truly horrible symptom. And by addressing the overlying like neuropsychiatric effects of nausea and its suffering, that person can chill out for a much longer time than the active ingredient ought to be lasting.
You mentioned that it's superior to oral but equivalent to IV. So is there a difference between IV and oral?
I think it's just two different trials, right?
Okay.
Right. So like at the end of the day, right, like are you doing ondansetron? Yeah. I mean, because that's a safe medicine that works and it's reliable. But mm-hmm. if if you're in a pinch and you, and it's going to take time to bring that up there and the person wants to give it a shot, then that's why I put it in my pocket when I'm rounding.
Yeah. Well, I just mentioned, because in the ICU, we love everything IV, right? And so it's always nice to know, is there really, truly, is it better IV versus PO? And you think, maybe, but not necessarily.
Yeah, I think it's just hard to give PO to somebody who's vomiting, and there's a good reason why it's an oral disintegrating tablet. Still, just putting something in someone's mouth when they're nauseous is just tough.
Let's do a quick one on paracentesis. We've talked about this in general when we talked about cirrhosis and ascites and so on. Traditionally, you will see at least diagnostic paracentesis taught with certain, you know, parts of the abdomen recommended as your best anatomic site, either safer or more likely to find a pocket. Nowadays, we're mostly using ultrasound, so some of this feels like it's become a little less relevant, almost like you can kind of, if anywhere you could find a pocket, and especially if you're looking for blood vessels using something like Doppler. Do you have an approach here? Do you start at a certain place or do you avoid certain places?
Yeah, I mean, the classic teaching is that you ought to avoid areas where you'd expect an epigastric vessel to be coursing. But the reality is these people with caput medusae, abdominal wall varices, can have a vessel anywhere in the abdomen. And so the long gone are the days where we would say you should be doing it exclusively in the right lower quadrant to avoid lacerating the spleen or the epigastric vessels. This is a case where point of care ultrasound was firmly established before we were doing any fancy vascular methods. If you're not using it, you are exposing the patient to it to increase risk. So I agree with you 100%. I like the right lower quadrant because I know there's no spleen there and I can sit up on that side of the bed. Sometimes these spleens are so big that you know ahead of time that it's going to be a spicy if you get into trouble in the left lower quadrant. But there's nothing wrong with going on the left side. Sometimes you have to move around, go up a little bit higher towards the umbilicus to find someone who has like loculated ascites. But as long as you are using the ultrasound to steer clear of vessels and ensuring that when you're taking a look, not only are you using the ultrasound to find the size of the pocket, but that you're also looking with the vascular probe and taking care not to compress anything when you're examining the abdominal wall, you'll avoid those vessels. And so I don't have any like firm rules other than look for vessels, make sure there's a pocket that's at least a couple of, at least an inch or two deep before you're putting a needle into it.
Let's jump to the liver and talk cholangitis. Patient comes to us, they're sick, they're febrile, hypotensive, they get imaging, maybe they have a dilated CVD, whatever. Maybe it's from a stone or stenosis or whatever. Often the next step is some sort of confirmatory imaging, not always. Sometimes you guys will suggest getting an MRCP. Sometimes it seems like going straight to an ERCP, I guess both sort of diagnostically and therapeutically makes sense. When do you sort of think about these different routes?
Okay, so I like this question. And if we just back up a little bit. So like in the super acute setting, a stone in the common bile duct can present with cholangitis and all of the sepsis type criteria. And if it happened immediately and that person was super sensitive to the infection, there might not be that much dilation on the bile duct. And so if you see very high liver enzymes, fever, and they're getting sick, and certainly if they have risk factors for cholangitis, like PSC or a known obstruction, people will go straight to ERCP appropriately. And if they're not in shock, sometimes what we'll do is an EUS, endoscopic ultrasound, to confirm that there is an obstruction before doing a sphincterotomy, which is where all of the risk of ERCP comes from, before accessing the duct and potentially increasing the risk of bleeding or pancreatitis. So there's ways that it can all be done in the procedure unit. And not anchoring on common bile duct dilation is incredibly important if the rest of the story sounds a lot like cholangitis. The other thing I want to bring up here is that someone can present with like an ALT of 1,000, and you immediately start thinking about Wilson disease and checking all of these fun labs. But One out of every five cases of a patient with an ALT over 1,000 is actually caused by a hyperacute obstruction of the common bile duct by way of stone. And that stone can be smaller than a little piece of gravel. It just caused a huge amount of pressure when it obstructed the sphincter of Oddi. You get an ultrasound, that obstruction just happened that day. And that's the reason why they presented to the hospital when they did. So you're not going to see much in the way of dilation. But if they don't appear septic and they have a high ALT, you're worried about them, but you know they're going to live throughout the day, you might want to get an MRCP just to be to diagnose it. But oftentimes, you'll get a classic story. This person was on semaglutide. They lost 45 pounds. They had a gastric bypass surgery. They lost 45 pounds. And then now they have severe pain with a prodrome of pain when they were eating, and their ALT is 1,000. That person can safely be booked for the procedure suite because the pretest probability of the stone is high, and we know that we have a potentially therapeutic and diagnostic procedure on the way. But it's when you get into that gray zone where, like, they could have elevated liver enzymes and jaundice because they're infected, and like infections can do that to the liver. But you're not sold, and they're sick. Like, you don't want to make them any sicker with a procedure that has risk. That's where we get the MRCP. And that indeterminate zone is informed in part by hard things like vital signs, how high the bilirubin is, and also the vibes, right? Like that I don't want to make anything worse, and I'm not 100% sold that I can make it better with an ERCP. So I would say, in general, my practice is going to be, if I'm worried about a stone and the story is like just totally locked up, we're going straight for ERCP. Otherwise, we'll wait the day or two that it takes to get the MRCP.
Every once in a while, and maybe particularly some of these cases where the CBD is not particularly dilated, somebody may want to get IR to place a drain, maybe because they don't seem stable enough for ERCP or something like that. But then sometimes, if that's not technically feasible, someone will try to stick a drain into the gallbladder. Which, of course, is not the site of infection, but I guess in a roundabout way, it could still decompress the bile ducts. What do you think about that?
Sometimes it's impossible to easily access the bile duct from the mouth. So in a patient with altered anatomy, they had a Whipple or a gastric bypass with a long limb, it's actually impossible or super challenging to snake an endoscope all the way around to that. And that's where IR shines. But for IR to access the bile duct that's diseased, there needs to be dilation. Otherwise, it's just impossible to get it through. Now, if you're going to stick a drain in the gallbladder, you better know what you're doing and hope that you can use it to relieve the actual obstruction. So if it doesn't relieve the obstruction, you'll just get some of the backflow, and the patient's sepsis will continue to go on. Sometimes you can go from the gallbladder and then twist it and get into the common bile duct and stent or punch the stone out that way. And that's totally reasonable. But where it isn't reasonable is that we're just placing a drain in the gallbladder and leaving it there. This segues a little bit to talk about the management of cholecystitis in someone who would be, quote unquote, not an operative candidate. And that there's no reason why those two things can't coexist. But since we're talking like a stone in the common bile duct and cholecystitis, but since we're talking about putting a catheter in the gallbladder and saying that it's possibly okay, I need to say that in most cases, it isn't. And that comfort with removing a diseased gallbladder is variable across surgeons. And it's really just a matter of finding somebody who would be a comfortable taking that patient to the operating room, temporizing them with support and antibiotics until such time that you can find that match. But if that is a diseased gallbladder and you put a drain in it, you might help the patient in the short term. You get relief of a lot of the pus. But then they're stuck with a drain in there, And they need to have the definitive procedure. And it, having been on the receiving end of that for patients of mine, where they have a painful catheter stuck in them and nobody wants to touch them because it wasn't their drain. They didn't place the drain. It's not their issue. Why can't you send them back to that hospital and have their surgeons take care of it? It's an extremely frustrating situation for the patient and for the person who takes care of them in a longitudinal practice.
Okay. Let's talk hepatorenal syndrome. Always a little confusing. Is there a kind of correct, simple diagnostic approach to diagnosing this disease? Or is it 90% ruling out other things and then presuming that's what it is? Do you make a lot of use of the urine sodium, for instance? How do you look at this?
Okay, another great question. The people with cirrhosis and ascites are at risk for hepatorenal syndrome. Just because someone has cirrhosis doesn't mean that their AKI is from hepatorenal syndrome. And that happens all of the time, where they get it in the chart because cirrhosis, HRS. Not true. So even a patient with cirrhosis and ascites, they are much more likely to have other causes for their kidney injury. So ATN is at least four times more common in these patients than HRS. So the first thing about diagnosis is someone should look at the urine and see if there's some classic set of muddy brown casts. And yet, the casts, there's often casts in the urine. And there's no way that you can be 100% certain about the diagnosis just based on what happens on day one. So time is ultimately what will help diagnose HRS and response to treatment. So if someone arrives with cirrhosis, ascites, and acute kidney injury, which I would define by a creatinine that rises by at least 0.3 over a recent baseline, my first step is to give them fluid. That's what we do. We blindly give them fluid. Hepatologist is prescribing albumin, but there's nothing magical about that. Many of these people have pre-renal AKI. You should give that to them. Now, if you are practicing in the 2025, what you ought to do is use ultrasound to understand more about their hemodynamics. And so a patient with cirrhosis and ascites can also have diastolic heart failure. And that person's not going to get better with albumin or extra fluids. And it's not against the law to withhold fluids. It's not against the law to give diuretics to somebody with AKI, cirrhosis, and ascites if the hemodynamics suggest that you would be on the right track. At the end of the day, response to treatment is going to be the ultimate arbiter of the truth of your diagnosis. So we're all giving albumin up front and seeing what happens. 24 hours, some people say, is enough. Most of the time, you need about 48 hours to figure it out. But if they really stop peeing and the creatinine is skyrocketing and you are convinced it's not ATN, then we go down the HRS pathway. And again, using time to validate our decision, the first thing you would do is start a real vasoconstrictor. If you're in the ICU and you're giving octreotide and midodrine, you are doing something wrong. You should be using norepinephrine. And I would start at 0.5 milligrams per hour and then increase it every couple of hours until you see an increase in the MAP and the urine output to know if you're on the right track. There was a recent approval of a medication by the FDA called terlipressin, like turbo vasopressin. That it met its primary endpoint in a trial, but most hospitals, including mine, we restrict its use outside of the ICU to people who don't have an oxygen requirement. So in the ICU, real vasoconstrictors, norepinephrine.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's get back to the gut. Ileus, another classic kind of prodrome of critical illness. Ileus is ileus. Does anything treat this disease, or we just have to wait it out? It's like ICU delirium.
Yeah. I find that this is a super frustrating problem that happens both in the ICU and on the floor. I would say the person's returned from surgery. Obviously, you're trying to wait it out. Sometimes there are things that we're doing to people that have prompted the ileus to get started or get worse. So a person with ileus ought not be getting giant bombs of lactulose, they're just going to end up with a super irritated gut and a ton of gas and bloating, and it will make things worse. So you definitely want to make sure that you're peeling back on things that will worsen the amount of volume in that gut.
Is there any role for laxatives, cathartics?
I think like is anything that's probably if you see a tremendous amount of constant like fecal loading that you think is impeding what flow and function you have, yeah, in that case, sometimes some kind of stimulation is going to be useful. So like an enema might kickstart things. Having people chew gum might be helpful. So sometimes I'll have people chew gum or have candy that was brought to them from the gift shop. But this is like wishful thinking. Every now and then we'll use methyl naltrexone, particularly if somebody has had a bunch of opioids. I don't think it's harmful. You'll see case series of people just giving it straight up for non-opioid related ileus. And some people will get better probably just because of the passage of time. Where things get worse is with like colonic pseudo-obstruction. And now you know you have ileus. You see the ascending colon, the cecum is getting bigger and bigger. It's 10 centimeters on a plain film. You're worried about potential perforation. And there you're starting to experiment with things like neostigmine, right? And putting them in the ICU for that, or putting them on telemetry as it's associated with bradycardia. We get consulted for that all of the time. And the answer is usually, let's give it a shot. The answer is not, can we do, like it's often, the question is often, can you do a colonoscopy and decompress this? And that's wishful thinking, right? So you might putting a tube in the stomach might help decompress how much fluid is being dumped into the gut. And that's a good idea. But putting a tube in the colon might decompress things. But in the process of doing that, you're going to be inflating the colon even further with more air. And I have not seen any tremendous benefits from that. So I'm sure there are definitely places and patients where placing a tube in the colon might be helpful. But it, by and large, that is not going to be the case. And trying to get by with pharmacologic management is the way forward.
All right. And now moving back up the gut to the stomach, we will sometimes use pro-kinetic, you know, pro-motility drugs, try to get the stomach to squeeze. Sometimes you guys ask for that in the setting of an EGD. Maybe you want to empty things out. Sometimes we use it because we think it's going to help something medical. I don't know, empty the stomach to reduce the risk of aspiration or various other things. Again, here, I think there's not that many options. Maybe we'll go to erythromycin. Our center actually doesn't have erythromycin, so people use azithromycin. I don't know if that's just as good. You got your metoclopramide. What's your approach here?
Yeah, so I think you're bringing up the classic case where a gastroenterologist would be asking for this, and this is in hopes of clearing the stomach after a recent large volume upper GI bleed. And here we do have some data in trials which detail exactly how much more clear the stomach is with one of these interventions. And so the best clearance you get is with IV erythromycin given 250 milligrams over less than an hour. The problem with that is that even in hospitals where it is available, it will take a very long time for it to get up from the pharmacy. For some reason, it's hours for that to happen. So most of us will then reach for metoclopramide. And there, the data is such that it's often the case you can clear a significant chunk of the stomach, at least where you would worry that gastric varices would be hiding, but you're still going to have a residual risk of needing a second look endoscopy. So if it works to clear the stomach of blood, it may very well work to clear the stomach of other contents. I don't think it's like pulling the cord on a lawnmower and you can just jumpstart the gut with this. In people with slow motility, there are really old data that if you give oral erythromycin, it will improve gastric emptying in the short term. But there's tachyphylaxis to long-term administration of erythromycin that happens after a few days. But there is very old randomized trial that shows that this will help in among outpatients. So I don't actually know if azithromycin is a reasonable alternative. I do think that metoclopramide is, and I just think you have to, it's a little bit more humble and you have to have a specific purpose in mind. And so clearing the stomach of blood for the purpose of diagnosis and potentially intervening on the underlying cause, that's a worthy purpose. But somebody whose gut has just stopped working after a major fall in surgery, I'm less enthused about its potential.
And do you think the PO versions of these drugs work any differently than IV, or can you give either?
I actually don't think that there would be a difference other than I bet you IV is faster. So I would not give somebody who had an upper GI bleed a bunch of oral erythromycin. But I brought it up just to say that it is an effect of the medication. It has been used for people with slow gut motility. So definitely this is a real effect of erythromycin on the gut. So in the ICU, it's IV. That's what I would be doing. Because again, the purpose here, like we're doing this, this is a real reason. The person is bleeding and we want to give them the best shot at the most minimally invasive approach to hemostasis.
Brian, what other GI topics do we have?
Well, you know, we talked about constipation, but we didn't really talk too much about its ugly cousin, diarrhea. I feel like we're starting a new podcast here, Talking Shit with Elliot Tapper. I'm getting all the poop topics, but I do feel like this is something we run into a lot in the ICU is diarrhea. And you sort of alluded to this when we talked about the 3-in-3 rule. If it's bothering someone, it should be treated, even if it's not technically what we might consider abnormal. What's your sort of your approach to treating just sort of run-of-the-mill diarrhea in the ICU?
Yeah. So the first thing that happens when someone has a loose bowel movement and GI is consulted is that they get a GI PCR test sent. And I'll never understand this, because what it will end up catching is carriage of some long dead virus that probably had no specific relation to the diarrhea, which was caused by you and the antibiotics that you gave them. So antibiotic associated diarrhea or illness associated diarrhea, these things are very common. You definitely don't want it to be C. diff. And so a much cheaper way of figuring this out is a C. diff test. That is the infection that I'm worried about. So multiple loose bowel movements that are interfering with their care, C. diff for sure. And then thinking about antibiotic stewardship, can we get them off some of these medications if they're on tube feeds? Is it that they're intolerant of them, slowing down tube feeds, adding like bran flakes to tube feeds? That's what we're doing. And then beyond that, we're just playing around with things like the low modal and low paramide. Sometimes the mistake is thinking that just a little bit is all that you need, when in fact, sometimes what you'll need to do is give a couple of the doses every couple of hours until such time that you get a response, with a maximum dose that varies somewhere around 8 or 16 of these pills in a given day. So if that diarrhea is causing severe problems that are interfering with their care, or hypernatremia, or severe volume losses and kidney injury, you need to address that. And my first line therapy is going to be things like the classic anti-diarrheal agents. There are some special cases where high volume output requires a trial of third line agents like octreotide injections. And you'll see this both for people with ostomies as well as people with underlying causes that would be better treated with that. But that's getting down the line, like you're in trouble. But at the point that you are thinking about putting a rectal tube to control the patient's bowel habit, you need to reevaluate, do they have C. diff? Are there antibiotics that we can stop? And then how else can we slow things down by maximizing, often with large doses of anti-diarrheal therapy?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned rectal tube too, because that was going to be my next question. Is I feel like definitely not all, but there's a certain subset of nurses who will call and ask for a rectal tube pretty quickly, I think. And I'm typically not one to put these tubes into folks. Is there a good guideline to when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate? Like, is there reasons not to place them, et cetera?
Well, I don't think I have a specific guideline, but I think like all tubes and drains, it should be evaluated on a round by round basis about whether or not it is indicated. And it's possible that in the heat of the moment, while you are adjusting 1,000 different drips and getting that person to and fro for different scans, that having a relatively low threshold is fully indicated. But then when the dust settles, keeping that tube in there increases the risk of like stercoral ulcers or delirium and so forth. So reevaluating it every 12 hours, every 24 hours is completely reasonable. The last thing I just want to add, which I forgot about in terms of diarrhea, are reviewing the medication list. So sometimes someone with diarrhea, they're getting like scheduled Miralax and or polyethylene glycol, and there's no reason for that. So just be mindful that we're not contributing it further. And finally, for hepatic encephalopathy, right? You definitely, someone shows up altered, you definitely want them pooping yesterday in order to resolve it. But if you are 2-3 days into that episode of encephalopathy and they are pouring stool out and they have not woken up, then you have reached the point of diminishing returns for diarrhea. And you might be making things worse, contributing to the encephalopathy by way of dehydration or abnormal sodium levels. So just because they are altered doesn't mean it is that you are underdosing the lactulose. You definitely need to get the bowel moving up front, but at some point that strategy runs aground, and that is when they have persistent diarrhea despite any response. Some people are just encephalopathic for many more days than the normal person who comes in grade 3-4 and then wakes up after a good slug of lactulose because that person's encephalopathy was triggered by the sedatives that they were given, the infection that rocked their world, and it takes a long time to clear all of those evil humors out, and they will not benefit from another tube and more diarrhea.
For those infectious diarrheas, like the C. diff or even something else, that one of the old teachings was like, you can't give them anti-diarrheal meds, you'll like kill them, it has to come out. What do you think? I mean, can we slow it down a little?
Yeah. So that's why I think like the first thing is make sure that they don't have a C. diff. And then after that, once I've excluded that and I've started treatment for it, then I feel comfortable slowly trying to get control of it. Nobody benefits from having large volume diarrhea that has hemodynamic consequences. Nor do I want this person to just turn off the faucet entirely. So there has to be a middle ground. We can't just swing from one extreme to the other. And so, whereas I was previously saying, just ramp up the loperamide until we slow down, I would play it a little bit slower and evaluate my progress over the course of days rather than hours as I find that middle ground.
Like they're having 10 stools. Maybe they could have 7. You know, they're pooping 3 liters a day. Maybe they can go 2. We're not going for 0
exactly
here.
Yeah.
Okay. Elliot, what other topics do you want to drop into the mix here? Any pet peeves you're having, stuff you want people to remember about, you know, stuff you come across often, those common consults?
On the topic of sky-high liver enzymes, I'm really glad that we talked about stones being a primary cause of that, particularly in the ICU. I'm glad you gave me the space to share my thoughts about tubes in the gallbladder. And then as we were talking about encephalopathy, and I brought up that sometimes it takes a while for people to wake up, I just want to just emphasize that Just because a patient with cirrhosis is altered doesn't mean that it's necessarily a lactulose deficiency, that encephalopathy will always be a vital sign, a biomarker of badness that ought to prompt you looking for, number one, an infection, number two, bleeding. And these infections, they're going to require you to do things. The sun ought not set on a diagnostic paracentesis. It has to happen as soon as you meet that patient, part of the physical exam even. But patients with cirrhosis will also present with infections in places you wouldn't normally think about. Dental abscesses, as dentition is super poor in this population more often than you'd expect. Skin infections that are hiding, you haven't turned them for a while, you haven't looked at the back. And so just being very mindful that even a patient who's not bumping their white count, that is a person who is telling you they're at high risk for dying because of an infection by way of their encephalopathy. And while lactulose might be part of the treatment plan, it is the second thing on the treatment plan. The first thing they need is a diagnosis for why they're encephalopathic that day.
All right. Well, that's been a great roundtable of GI. I think this has been great. As always, thank you so much for joining us, Elliot. You're our fan favorite, and I think this episode shows why. Lots of good stuff here.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us. And just a reminder, this is all just general educational content. It shouldn't be taken as medical advice. And, you know, the three of us, we're just talking. We don't represent our in various institutions. These are all just our own thoughts. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.